Welcome everyone to the Her Rise Salon. Hey, sweet mates. Welcome, welcome, welcome to all those that are watching live on LinkedIn, live on Facebook, and our YouTube channel. If you don't know, I'm Marsha Guerriere, founder of Her Sweet Spot, a digital platform helping women of color start, grow, and scale their business, develop their business plan, reach their goals, and increase their revenue and get access to funding. We're celebrating Black History Month with a conversation with Dr. Erica T. Tate, as you see, diversity, equity, and inclusion consultant and founder of Blue Knowledge LLC, a learning firm that advances equity through the design and study of learning experiences in schools and communities. For 20 years, she's worked to positively change education and community health through research, design, and evaluation through quantitative and qualitative methods to investigate evidence-based practices that support learning and health among children, youth, and adults, individually and as families and communities. Erica provides high quality and responsive design, research and evaluation consulting and advisory services on nationally funded research grants. Examples include National Science Foundation and many, many others that she supports. Her community-based projects have focused on realizing racial equity in education, increasing food access in under-resourced communities, engaging parents in childhood obesity prevention, and growing the number of insured children. Through her life's work, she aims to empower equity-driven learning for all, amplifies voices often unheard, and advocates for change that benefits those who need it most. We are here celebrating Black History Month and taking a journey to equality today. Welcome, Erica.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Or Dr. Erica, as I love to say. Put some respect on my name. Dr. Erica, it is great to have you here. Why don't you say hello to everyone? And although your bio is extensive, is there anything else you want to add to that long list of accomplishments that you have?
No. I'm excited to have the opportunity to be here and to have a conversation with you, Marsha, and really celebrate Black history and conversation. So thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. We're going to get into today's topic, but something I didn't prep you for is, what does Black history mean to you?
Oh, so this is great. I love Black History Month that I also affectionately call Every Day. I love it so much because I think it's the opportunity to really add stories about accomplishment, Black inspiration to like our knowledge bank and to our narrative. And so I always appreciate the opportunity to come together. And no matter where you are during Black History Month, whether you're watching TV, whether you're on social media, you're in your church, you always hear all these stories of just great accomplishment that we have achieved as a people. And I think that it's a great way to celebrate who we are and to build up our identity. So I'm very much appreciative when people speak up and share those stories. And if the month of February jumpstarts you, awesome. And I hope that, you know, these conversations and these stories continue all year long, because we are here all year long and we need to be celebrated.
Yes, I do love the way so much unsung heroes are spoken of, and we learn so much. Even me as a Black woman here in this country, born and raised, I do feel as a first generation, I learn so much every day and I live it every day. But I am especially thankful for some of the lessons that we get to teach and learn this month. But I want to get into talking about you, your work in building equity and equitable spaces, and not just education. So your bio really speaks to education, but I know you, Dr. Erica, I've known you for a couple of years. I know the work you do outside of just education. So can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you became the DEI consultant that you are now?
Yes, definitely. So I grew up in a military family. My dad was in the United States Air Force, and we moved around many, many times. I went to nine different schools. But my parents were really good at helping us settle into communities and become part of it. Even if we weren't going to stay for long, we never felt that way. Like, we connected to churches and beauty salons and other like youth spaces so that we could really feel grounded no matter where we were. And I think that love of community, that ability to build community, just carried on. And when I was in my undergraduate years, I went to school for engineering, and I really got into diversifying the STEM pipeline, so science, technology, engineering, math, and getting women and students of color into the fields, but also supported in their journey throughout. And so, like, I worked with the National Society of Black Engineers. I worked with the Dean's Office to do some of the programs, initiatives. And so these were all the extracurricular activities or like work study jobs that I had. And then after I graduated, I moved and I worked for a bit as an engineer, but soon pivoted into education, where I supported undergrads transitioning to graduate school, first generation, Black and Brown students, women, and really trying to have them understand what it takes to go to graduate school, as well as making connections and building relationships with faculty who are gatekeepers in those spaces. And while I was in that position, I transitioned to graduate school. I learned that you could design curriculum that engage students, and you could use technology to do so. And through my studies, I ended up designing a STEM curriculum that centered on social justice. And so it engaged teachers and high school students in a asthma problem in their community, where they had to think about policies and interventions and their communities and their identities within, in order to learn not just about the physiology, but also about some of the social factors that affect their community and their lives. And we use data from their communities. But in order to do that, I had to work with coalitions of the community. And I think that's where it got started. I was like with grassroots organizations, as well as organizations where people's job was to come together as committee. And I just, when it was time for me to graduate, I just couldn't go into academia. I felt that I was part of the community as much as people would let me. I wanted to contribute to community spaces. And so, and a couple of years after graduation, I founded Blue Knowledge as a social justice firm, and have taken on projects, many of which you described when you read my bio, but from education, of course, but also public health, workforce development, children's obesity, children's insurance. And so I just, any project that centers equity, any project that engages stakeholders with a, in a respectful manner and shows appreciation for their lived experiences and appreciation for like the assets and resources that they bring, as well as, you know, advocating for it, I'm down. I'm excited to be a collaborator, a contributor, a leader in that work. And that's where I am, and I know I'm supposed to be there. So it was a twisty turn, you know, twisty journey, but I think I'm here, and you know, the journey will continue. But that's how I ended up doing the work that I do.
Your background is so, I wouldn't say similar to mine, because I didn't graduate with an engineering degree, but as a woman in STEM careers, right? In technology, as I have been for the last 30 years, and using that as the foundation to start, we share a lot of the same things, the work that we do in STEM, right? And the work that we do to empower our communities through knowledge. It right now, you were in the STEM field as an engineer, and you transitioned out because you saw a lot of what was happening from behind, from within, and you wanted to empower and give knowledge and access to these resources and information to the communities. What do you think right now? I'm gonna get into this. What do you think right now, Erica, with what's happening with the state of technology and what the companies that are, you know, on this impending, or I don't know if we're in it or it's coming, the recession, ooh, the doom that's on its way, right? Yet corporations are still making record-breaking profits, but somehow they're betting down, hedging on getting rid of people. And I've been reading a lot of articles, Dr. Erica, on diversity being at risk for one of those budget-saving items. What do you say to corporations about the risk that they may be taking for lowering the budget that was already frayed, that was already kind of non-existent in the DEI space. That department generally gets the least amount of budget, right? What do you say to people when they say it's going to be chopped off?
Yeah, a few things. One is that I always like go from I'm an engineer to educator, but in that period of pivot was actually another the bubble bust in Silicon Valley. So after I graduated, I moved all the way across the country to work in Silicon Valley, and I had worked for an organization where I interned because they had diversity. They wanted to increase the number of underrepresented engineers in their lab. And so one way to do that, right, is to recruit interns and to bring them through during the summer, because you can be more targeted about the schools that they come from, and also give them a good experience so that when it's time to hire, you can hire them. And so I moved across the country. I was very excited. And was 1 month after I got there, the bubble burst. And I was one of those students who as soon as graduation happened, I moved across the country because I had no money. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I hope that, they don't lay me off because I just bought my first car ever and I would hate to have to live out of it because of this recession the downturn. But also I say that as a joke, but also because, when we recruit for diversity, sometimes we recruit people out of their communities and out of their safety nets. And so when you turn the table and you're like, well, bye-bye, you have to think about where are they going and what supports do you have to transition them out of your organization for reasons that are beyond their control. And then we got saved because of this acquisition and ended up moving to another company. And it had a different culture and different set of priorities, but I did all the things that I thought I was supposed to do. I joined the Black Employees Network. Our local lab, had a local kind of initiative to try to support people of color who were engineers and women in this space. And as soon as that production schedule got real tight, as soon as the bottom line became the number one thing, they ended up prioritizing those diversity efforts. And it really took a toll because it was a space that really needed it. Me and another colleague, we were the first Black women that almost everyone in the organization worked with, right? And so they didn't really understand us. They didn't know how to talk to us. Some of them were scared, right? And it just became an environment that was not fulfilling to my soul. And so I transitioned and they gave me an exit interview. And in that exit interview, I shared with them that of course, companies have their mission, right? And they have these objectives or production schedules that they need to meet. But when you guys deprioritized your diversity efforts because it was no longer what was hot, it really made it uncomfortable for me. It really made a difficult space for me. And I think that as organizations are moving into this space where there are hard decisions to make, if DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, justice, right, are all of these are part of their mission, or these are things that they want to be part of their systems, then they really need to keep that front and center because they need to take a look at just on the representation, angle, who is being let off and is that shifting the representation? And are you laying off the champions of this work and those types of considerations so that you don't go back to square one because it took so much effort and energy to even put diversity, equity, and inclusion on the table.
Love that you took your exit interview as an opportunity to save those coming behind you. Because as we know, we're afforded some of the luxuries and some of the privileges that we have, non-privileges, but because of the men and women that came before us in this country, right? And working to build a more equitable society for us to live. How do you think individuals can play a role while they're still there, right, in promoting that DEI and their personal roles that they play while still inside corporate America?
Right. I think it's, having an open channel of communication, right? So what happens is oftentimes we ask people about their experience as they're out the door, which is one way to get some honest experience, but they're out the door. And then of course you might want to leave some parting words of wisdom and advice, but what would the situation have been if you regularly and consistently asked people who are most affected by the policy changes or lack of policy changes that you have about their experiences and ask for their input about what would make them feel more included in the company mm-hmm. culture, make them feel like they have a chance for promotion or movement through or and across organizations. And so I think that individuals who are in managerial positions or any position in which they are responsible for others have to take it upon themselves and hopefully with the company's support to ask those who they manage about their experiences and figure out whatever way works that allows for both, not so much, that allows for the person that you're asking for to feel comfortable or just empowered to share that information and then have that feedback be something that's real and something that feeds into your continuous cycle of improvement processes that many organizations have. And I think for those who aren't in those positions and who are trying to create, you know, who those policies help make them feel more comfortable, help make them feel included, realized, supported, and you know, whatever journey that they're going on, is when they can feel brave enough to do that, but maybe do that with others. I try to think about what's that collective, you know, the collective power that you might have. And I say that like when I made that example, like when I went to the new company, I quickly joined the Black Employee Network. Some of it just social, like, you know, I want to see my people, but also because like I knew that being one of few that I just don't have that much power to change and I'm in an entry level position. So the more that I could have access to other people and, you know, that collective power as well as mentorship and sponsorship to support me in this space, that could have been helpful if the company could support those types of efforts.
So collective power is key and one of the major benefits for employee resource groups and affinity groups. It is really important because we enter in spaces where we often are the onlys and often are isolated and are not building networks. So being able to come together, share experiences, and you know, promote one another within is key. And to the organizations, that's where you come in with Blue Knowledge, right? That's research element when an organization right now is looking to make improvements to their DEI efforts to understand if it is something that they should or should not reduce in budget right now. The work that you do with research, data analysis, and evaluations, would that is that a step organizations should do before deciding?
Yes, absolutely. Because one of the things that helps us make decisions is information. And information can come in many aspects, both like the quantitative data and numbers about our people, as well as qualitative. Like I, you know, a one-on-one conversation, a lunch with an employee tells us a lot of things. But I also think that in organizations where they're really working hard to increase diverse representation. So they have they're doing that because they want a goal of a more inclusive organization where people feel like they're belonged and heard and appreciated, but they have to get those numbers up in many cases. And I think that when you are able to understand those numbers and gather those numbers, you're more successful. So some of the things that we've done when evaluating organizations, especially organizations that have targets around the representation of their group. So maybe they want more Black women, or maybe they want to have more students from communities that are low wealth, right? If they have these type of goals, they have to think about how are they recruiting? What net are they casting? And then also, what does it look like across the process? And so you've cast your net, right? You've looked at who's applied, and now you want to think about who's interviewing, who gets offered, who takes the position, and then of course, who stays in the organization. And when you can look at those numbers across those different phases of the process, you can identify those leaky spaces, and you can also identify what is it that you need to do. It allows for you to then move from data to dialogue and be able to talk about using this evidence, what strategies do you need to put in place so that you are reaching the community that you want and in respectful, positive ways that your interview process is not pushing them out of the funnel, but actually keeping them in and allowing you to better understand the range of resources that they bring in, as well as retention. So you get them all the way through this process, and then they're gone in 3 to 6 months. So what's happening within your organizational processes that are doing that? And I think the flip is with these increased layoffs, right, mm-hmm. that are happening across companies, because often, you know, what's that? It's like a proverb, but you leave with as much care as you enter, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's like usually to tell us not to burn our bridges yes. as we're going out, but it's usually on the person leaving. But the organization needs to also pay attention to that data, right? On the end, you know, if you say we're just going to lay off because of these criteria that they think are really objective, but all the people that you've brought in through your DEI initiatives or these new hiring practices end up in this one department, and then you cut that department, you've lost all the progress that you've had, and it's gonna take even longer to bring that back. So taking that same lens of watching that exit funnel happen and using that as data, as well as like the exit interviews, as well as like follow-ups or conversations with other people who have more connection to the employees than maybe like, you know, someone who's removed or in central office. But I think those types of investigations or inquiry into organizations really help because they're targeted, they're informed by evidence, and they jumpstart mm-hmm. dialogue, which we hope leads to action that makes people feel like they want to work in a space that supports them giving to an organization and whatever their mission is.
You know, I feel like we're always listening to you. We're always two steps forward, one step back in our fight for that equality. And the times like this, where we're in recession or down economic downturn, who's the most impacted, right? Our communities always seem to be at the top of the impact. What do you think is going to be the biggest challenges, or what are some of the current challenges that the Black community is facing now?
Yeah, I think that the biggest challenge that the Black community faces is that these challenges are compounded, right? We have challenges related to our health, but challenges related to our workforce, challenges related to schoolings and education, challenges related to business and business startup, or, you know, we have all of these we have all of these challenges. And so we have it compounded across like sectors or different spaces, but also we have it compounded throughout history and over time. And so mm-hmm. when you think about Black people in the US, but in other countries across the world, but say in the US context, like we were stolen from Africa, brought here to work for free, which like completely affects our ability for economic empowerment. You know, there was violence against our bodies. It was illegal for us to read, illegal for us to get education. And throughout the years, this really has compounded and increased not just challenges, like barriers, mm-hmm. gates that keep us from moving forward. And I mean, there has been collective power. Like, we have changed, we have made progress, but it still has, I think it's more than just residual effect. It's still greatly impacting our communities. And when we look today and we think about our education system and whether or not we can learn well in that space, but even feel safe in that space, if we look to our health, when you think about the racial disparities among our health outcomes, access to healthcare, and thinking about our abilities to earn money so that we can take care of their families, whoever they are, whatever they look like, in the ways that we desire. And I think what happens is when those compound, it takes a physical toll on our body. It takes causes us mental anguish. It's a huge emotional toll.
Right.
And we have to like figure that out. Right. And then go into this.
Are we not the most resilient group of people on the planet? Right.
Yes.
That intersectionality between all of the disparities that you just mentioned. You know, I think of my son, he was in third grade. We just mastered multiplication, right? And yes, and then now third grade algebra, geometry is coming along, and it's like, woo, right? How can we fight against all of the barriers in every intersect of our lives, right? What is it? Because it feels like in every section, it's one step forward, and then here comes something in another area. What is it you can advise us now to really help us overcome that impact of intersectionality?
Well, I think we're doing it now. I mean, when you look across, look across the Black community and other communities of color, there are organizations and coalitions that are working, that are raising awareness about the challenges that are facing, that are pinpointing either policies or pinpointing resources that we don't have access to, and working very hard to do that. And they're doing that in their sectors. And I think that's great. And we want to keep supporting them. We want to keep pushing them. And putting resources into these organizations that are trying to move the needle on equity or achieving equitable outcomes. But I also think that coalition building, we know that these sectors intersect. Like, I can't talk about education without talking about the economic viability of the community that the school is in. And so creating more partnerships across that and seeing how we can work together to address these issues, because they're systemic, right? Just bringing the right partner, and by that I mean like the partner that's aligned with mission, the partner that's committed to making this change, that has processes in place, like direct services to families who need food, who need access to housing, right? Who also partner up with organizations that can provide advocacy for education, but then also engage those parents in a way so that they feel empowered to advocate for their children or other children of the community. Because once you begin advocating for yourself and others, you continue to do that. And right. Either you do that through your, personal time, or you make it a profession and you make it a job to do this work.
Business.
Yes, right. To do this work. I think coalition building, I think the more that we're able to see these overlaps and to come together as organizations that are, committed to making change in these ways, I think we'll move it forward, because it is overlapping and it's compounding. And so we need to make sure that we try our best to do that. And I think funding needs to come in place to allow for those partnerships and coalition building to happen, because every business is doing all that they can to work in their field. But when we start to work across, there is learning and processes that need to be in place, that need to be funded to support this efforts.
And I know you're working with individuals and businesses to help them develop the type of programmings that you're talking about, the type of businesses and I call them do-gooder companies, right? As side hustles or as full-time jobs. What are some steps people need to do if they're thinking about the work that they could do to contribute, right, to the breaking of the barriers? What are some steps and advice you would give to someone who's watching, who really wants to go all in?
Yes. Oh, well, first of all, welcome. Congratulations on making that choice. I think like the first step is really figuring out where you want to put your efforts, right? Because there are so many spaces in which inequities live, and there are so many possible pathways to solution. Mm-hmm. And I think one way for individuals is to think about like their, it's always crazy because we always talk about like being objective, but this is actually a place where you need to be subjective and really think about your experiences and what it is throughout your life that affected you. What is it throughout your life experiences that you had, interactions with people and communities that had a strong impact, both in terms of, for some of us, right, sometimes that impact caused harm, right? That impact was hurtful, but also there were communities and people that you connected with that it was not, that helped you or provided you with a resource. And I think thinking about that and identifying those points in your life allow for you to identify where you want to put your passion and where you want to put your purpose. And then also thinking about next is like, what are those skills that you possess? And so sometimes these are skills that we learned on jobs that might not be directly related to where you are. But also there might be things that you learned in the community. I mean, you think about coalition building is not taught in school, like partnerships and nurturing relationships, that happens in your life, right?
Even at home, right? As caregivers, right. As head of household,
yes,
we are, put it on your resume. We are doing the things that make us all great leaders.
Yes.
And we don't see it sometimes, right?
No, yes. And you need to know that you are a leader. You're a leader in your home. You're a leader in your community, in your church, and in your spaces. And you connect with other leaders. And so I think when people are able to identify where they want to make an impact based on, you know, their lives and their passion, they're able to identify the skills and the like learnings that they've gathered throughout their personal and professional lives, and then start to make a plan. And so identify organizations that are doing that work, identify people who are bringing and discussing, bringing like different frames and lenses. Like they're discussing this work through a lens of anti-racism. They're discussing this work through a lens of intersectionality, like Black women, so that we can see these different inequities and these different possibilities for change, and then start to make your path toward that. You might want to join an organization and begin to work with them. You might volunteer, you know, but like if you have that ability, that's not a requirement. You can always get a job, you know, you might start a business where you're providing a service that contributes to these organizations or that contributes to the change that you want to make. But I think each time we make a step to enact, like or interact with the communities that we want to serve or the organizations that are serving the communities that we care about, we learn and it makes clearer for us what we want to do and how we want to do it. And then when you find that, right, when you find that space that you can call, like, you know, your work home, right, or your purpose or your mission home, then, you know, like, then, you know, you have to make plans based on whatever that is. But I think we have a lot of, you know,
and you help support people through that.
Yes.
I have been working with you for several years now, and you are really making an impact and really making a change in so many lives. And I know that one day we're going to see Dr. Erica's name in lights, y'all. And because what you're doing to really broaden the awareness of the inequalities, and to bring, you know, you started Blue Knowledge as a social justice organization, and it has evolved because, listen, the light got to get paid, right? And so business has to happen, but the work that you're doing is what I want people to understand. Your mission never goes away just because you are continuing to find ways to build revenue. To making money is not a dirty thing, right? You know, funding your passion projects is not a bad thing. So you are a great example for me, and why you are this month's Her Sweet Spot member spotlight for women and women of color, Black women, to see that you can build a thriving business doing important work. I know you mentioned early on, and it's something I wanted to touch on, Dr. Erica, that you and your family were really ingrained into like the churches, the beauty salons, and that is really the community that we build around our homes as a Black community, right? The salon, the barbershop, it is a very mainstream thing. And when you look at the number of people in careers that are outside of STEM, and that's where people of color, Black people, particularly Black women, most hold their careers and or start businesses. For you being a part of STEM and making that a source of inspiration is something to be admired. So thank you for the work that you're doing, Dr. Erica. Can you share with anyone, with us all watching and listening, what your lasting advice would be to organizations and individuals who are starting off and prioritizing DEI, and what you, how they can get in touch with you?
Yes. So my last piece of advice is really, I always think about it in this way, is no matter where you are in your organization and what your like mandate or requirements are, and whether you're focusing on like changing policy or you're focusing on these processes or products, right? That's usually the things of business. Remember that people are at the center of them. And so we make better products, we make better processes, we make better policies when we center people first and we think about all the experiences that people are bringing to our world, and we think about it and we We know in our hearts that they are valued, that they are appreciated, and that they are loved. And I think when we can start there, we make better decisions about our organizations and better decisions about the impact that we want our organizations to make. And if you want to catch up with me, you can follow me on LinkedIn. You can visit my website, www.blueknowledge.com. I host a show, Remix EQ Live, where we talk about different issues related to equity. And I interview guests who drop knowledge and inspiration and allow for us to continue to learn across different sectors, as well as in different communities. Yes, please connect with me. I love making connections. And I love building community. So I look forward to connecting with you.
Yes. Well, thank you, Dr. Erica, again for joining me on today. Guys, you know, we're celebrating Black History Month, but this is just the springboard for you to continue on educating yourself and immersing yourself in Black knowledge and Black culture. You know how I like to end each show. Until next time, when we empower each other, we all rise. Bye for now.